is to pull off the upset in the 2015 finals, James communicated with Bryant. Never in his career had James been an advice seeker, but he was willing to listen to Kobe. Because of injuries and circumstance, Bryant and James only played each other 22 times, even though they were in the league for 13 seasons together. James polished off his 16th win against Bryant with 24 points. Bryant gave a final strong performance against James, making 11 of 16 shots and scoring 26 points. "We're two sportsmen and we love the lights," James said. "We get up for the best moments, and for us to give the fans and our beautiful sport one last opportunity to watch us both on the same floor and give them a show, it was great." As he left the James rivalry behind, Bryant had a few words of wisdom to impart. "You have to be true to who you are and authentic," he said. "And I think every team should have that lightning rod, because the happy-go-lucky stuff doesn't work. I don't care what anybody says. You have to have that inner conflict. You have to have that person that's really driving those things. From the Cavs' perspective, it's hard for me to tell from afar who should be that person. LeBron's not that person. He brings people together. That's what he does naturally, and he's phenomenal at it. But you have to have somebody else that's going to create that tension. Maybe it's Kyrie." Bryant was half right. Some more inner conflict was coming, but it wasn't from Irving. It was from James, and it left his new coach and his general manager irate. Chapter 15, Meeting at Trump's. On a Monday morning, as the Cavs finished a game day walkthrough preparing for the Denver Nuggets, Ty Lue asked LeBron James to come in for a meeting. Lue was unhappy and he was going to address it. The team spent the previous weekend in Florida, first beating the Orlando Magic, but then getting crushed by the Miami Heat. In Miami on Saturday night, the entire team had laid an egg. The Heat were playing well despite losing star Chris Bosh for the season and were a potential playoff opponent. This losing of focus was a bad habit. Losing happens, but losing with an absence of effort is a plague in the NBA. Coaches treat it like a mold. It has to be killed before it spreads. But none of that was what Lue wanted to talk to James about. At halftime in Miami, James went to the center of the floor and spent several minutes talking to friend Dwayne Wade. They covered their mouths with their warm-up so they couldn't be overheard. But whatever they were saying was funny, because James was laughing. At the time, the Cavs were down 21 points. Lue was all for fraternization with friends. He was one of the most connected guys in the league. One of the things that awed David Griffin about Lue in his first season was seeing players from opposing teams come up to him before games. Before, not during. Lue thought James's actions set a bad example. He wanted to stamp it out. "I just told him we can't have that. Being down like we were and him being the leader," Lue told Cleveland.com about the meeting. "Just me being a competitor, I didn't like it. We had a long talk about it. It was good. He understood. He apologized." This was a time when it was fair to judge the difference between David Blatt and Lue. Blatt avoided confrontations with James, something James eventually started to take advantage of. Lue was not afraid to seek them out. It had already been happening in film sessions and huddles. Lue had told players, including James, to shut up during timeouts. James still held tremendous influence, and Lue made him a partner in some decisions, but James was not going to go largely unchecked by the coach anymore. Lue thought this chat did its job. That day, James opened his Twitter account and unfollowed the Cavs' official account. A few days later, he would explain that this was the beginning of him focusing in a run-up to the playoffs. He had a routine of blocking out distractions during the postseason, and he was starting early this year, perhaps his discussion with Lue being a factor. Once again, however, without context, the move seemed strange. Another coded social media message. He unfollowed other accounts as well, but with more than 25 million followers, nothing he did on the platform went unnoticed. That he went out and led the team to win over the Nuggets that night, putting up a triple-double that clinched the Central Division title, seemed to be less important to many fans who were perplexed or even alarmed by the move. James became annoyed the focus was on social media and not his play and refused to talk about it. The next day, Bleacher Report released a long-planned story about James and friend Carmelo Anthony. James had done an interview for the piece 6 weeks earlier. In it, he talked about how someday he'd love to play on the same team as Anthony and his other close NBA friends, Chris Paul and Wade. This group had been calling itself the Brotherhood. Their families were close and they vacationed together the previous summer, chartering a yacht and sailing out into the Atlantic for a week off the Bahamas. It would be definitely cool if it happened, but we don't know how realistic it could be to have us four, James said in the interview. If you got the opportunity to work with three of your best friends, no matter what, it's not even about sports. It's about being around guys that you don't even have to say nothing. You automatically know. We just have that type of history. Can it happen? I don't know if it can even happen, but it would be cool. It was a hypothetical and only a small part of the story. It was also an old interview. But that's not how the public consumed it, or James's teammates. What they saw was this progression. James visits Wade in Miami. James chats Wade up during a blowout loss. James unfollows Cavs. James talks about wanting to play with his close friends a few months before becoming a free agent again. With all the issues the Cavs were having getting themselves together on the court, this was unneeded turbulence. Griffin was especially upset. He'd stuck his neck out by firing a coach on a first-place team because he was concerned about the togetherness of the team, and James was not helping matters. Griffin wasn't delusional. He knew even with these hiccups, James was one of the most valuable players in the history of the league. Because of meaningless blips in the news cycle, that's a deal he was thrilled to make. But Griffin also stressed during the coaching change that accountability in the organization was paramount. He had to back up his words, or his credibility was at stake. So after seeing the story, he asked to meet with James. It wasn't just Lou and Griffin who were wondering what James was up to. His close friends were puzzled too. James typically saw all angles. Awareness and foresight are two of his greatest traits. The same ability that allows him to see passing lanes or predict chances to grab steals carried off the floor. He was highly aware of what his words and actions could do. He'd become an expert at leveraging this gift, whether it was to generate business opportunities, motivate teammates, or sublimely tweak rivals. He didn't like it, but James knew all this activity had the potential to cause problems. He was off his rocker for a little while, James's friend and business partner Maverick Carter told Sports Illustrated. He's a perfectionist. He likes everything perfect, and he knew his team could be better. Whether it was the talk with Lou, the talk with Griffin, or the urging of those in his inner circle, James did respond. There would be no more self-inflicted controversies from him the rest of the season. It wasn't going well, and I had to look in the mirror, he told SI. I had to reset, recalibrate, and get out of that little funk I was in. A few days later, the team went to New York City for a 3-day stay, where they'd play both the Nets and Knicks. At the first stop, in Brooklyn, they had yet another inexplicable performance. The Nets, one of the worst teams in the league, won by 9. The Cavs were miserable in the fourth quarter, with Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love missing all their shots. But they were 10 games away from starting the playoffs, healthy and loaded with talent. The Golden State Warriors, their chief rivals, were a few days away from locking up their 70th win, and the Cavs were still having huge breakdowns. Lou had seen enough. The next day there was no practice, but a film session was scheduled. Film became the least important thing. The team was staying at the Trump Soho, a high-rise tower with floor-to-ceiling windows overlooking Lower Manhattan. But no one in the ballroom was looking out them. Lou took control of the room and unleashed a profanity-laced challenge to his players. He targeted his three stars. He said they had to trust each other. They had to set a standard of knowing what each of them were going to bring every night. Not some nights, every one. He said they had to police each other. If one guy didn't do his job, they were responsible for calling them out. Lou especially went after Love and his habit of fading away when teammates weren't including him. He told Love he was a great player, and he should demand his teammates, especially James and Irving, respect him and include him. It was not the type of discussion that would usually happen in late March, but nothing about this season had been typical. Lou had made it clear on his team there was no golden child. Everyone was open to being called out, just as everyone could be praised, even if it were the Stars. Then he yielded the floor to the players, and they had their say. It became a giant therapy session. To change culture, you can't treat everyone the same way, Lou said. Sitting down and getting on the same page of understanding what they need from each other on a nightly basis and understanding what they have to do to trust each other and also trust the team. We had that talk in front of everyone, and everyone kind of gave their opinion and kind of talked about what they expected and what they needed to do better. I think from that day on, we kind of took off and we became a better team. It wasn't just the players. Lou had looked inward. The team defense had regressed since he took over. His new assistant, Mike Longobardi, had highly detailed scouting reports and game plans. On paper, it was impressive, but on the fly, the team wasn't executing. They'd been the sixth best defensive team in the league under Lou. Since Longobardi became the defensive coordinator, they'd dropped to 13th. Lou admitted he'd overreached and made a mistake. He tossed out the complex defensive coverages and went back to a more basic approach, and he would again oversee the defense within the game. The next day, the Cavs whipped the Knicks at Madison Square Garden. James had another triple-double, and Love looked refreshed, scoring 28 points with 12 rebounds. It kicked off a hot streak for Love. He'd averaged 19 points and shoot 46% on three-pointers over the last 10 games of the regular season. His confidence, it seemed to the team, spawned from the meeting where Lou had given him a tough Love pep talk. It wasn't just Love. In the coming weeks, Lou would refer to that gathering being a turning point in the team's mindset. Whether it was the words or the calendar, the playoffs were almost there. The Cavs' days of aimless performances were at an end. But there was still distraction. It was Irving's turn. During the season, he'd publicly been dating a popular young R&B singer, Kalani Parrish. Both of them had huge fan bases among teens and young adults, and their relationship played out on social media and the gossip sites. In March, they broke up. Kalani began dating an ex-boyfriend, Canadian recording artist Jerron Brathwaite, who performed under the name Party Next Door. After several days of attention where she was accused of cheating on Irving, Kalani attempted suicide. The resulting drama of the supposed love triangle forced Irving to address the situation. It was a stressful time for Irving, who was privately still dealing with the relationship ending. Then it became public that Kalani was from Oakland and a Warriors fan. She had recorded a song celebrating the team's victory over Irving's Cavs the previous summer, only added fuel to the hecklers who were descending into Irving's real and digital life. "I've been through a ton of adversity in my life," Irving said. "There's nothing anything or anyone can say that I can't get through. I've been through enough already in my short 24 years that most people can say for their whole entire lives." That may have been what he was telling himself, but his game suffered. After his personal life became a headline generator, he went into a week-long slump. Compounding matters, he was under the weather. He rebounded with a clutch overtime three-pointer in Atlanta, and the Cavs beat the Hawks in a game that felt like a playoff matchup. It was crucial for them keeping their lead on the Raptors for the top seed in the East. James had 29 points in the win, but Irving's 20 and his big basket seemed to help improve his mood. "Everything surrounding our team is just crazy," Irving said. "To think that we're still in first place and we're still the team to beat, honestly." Irving created more attention by calling the Cavs the team to beat, with the Warriors setting records. At least this reaction was to basketball, though, and that was a relief, even if Lou tried to temper enthusiasm a bit. But Irving was correct. The team had weathered a remarkable number of distractions. They still were erratic at times, and that was worrisome looking forward. But in general, they showed resiliency. Something else was happening behind the scenes. They were becoming closer as a team. The catalyst for it was unexpected. New pickup Channing Frye. He was helping on the floor. 4 times in his first month with the team, he made 4 or more three-pointers in the exact role Griffin had envisioned. And his sunny disposition and daily joy started rubbing off on his teammates. "I get excited for everything," Frye said. That's just who I am. I get excited when we get into these nice hotels and I see how many different soaps we have to choose from. It's Fry's nature, but it is also the result of a life-altering situation he experienced several years earlier, in which a heart ailment not only put his career in peril, but also threatened his life. He ended up missing an entire season. After his recovery, his outlook on his career took a turn. Some players say they're happy just to be in the NBA. Fry truly meant it. His positivity, and frankly, his naivete, ended up being a bonus. He played in all four corners of the league, from New York to Portland to Phoenix to Orlando, but he was blown away by the amenities provided for the players in Cleveland. He was especially impressed with the made-to-order breakfast options at the team facility, that he could have a chef whip up a fresh burrito with a whole wheat tortilla, egg whites, goat cheese, and chicken sausage left him in awe. And then there was the French toast. When I first saw the spread, I was like, free burritos before shoot around? Are you kidding me? This is the best, Fry wrote in an essay for the Players Tribune. Life moves so fast in the NBA, sometimes we players don't appreciate the little things. Let's enjoy this wonderful French toast, made-to-order omelets. Let's eat these breakfast burritos. Let's get some wins and let's make history. Fry arrived after the Blatt drama, after the early spats between the stars, after the contract stalemates. He was a fresh face in every regard, and with his close friend and former college teammate Richard Jefferson, he was generating smiles throughout the team. Fry was unaware, for example, of the cliques. James had his closer friends, J.R. Smith, James Jones, and Tristan Thompson mostly, and other players had regular dinner partners and conversationalists on flights and bus rides. Once Fry got everyone's cell phone numbers, he started sending group texts to numerous guys looking to set up dinners or have conversations about games that were happening on TV. All of a sudden, I was just on a text chain with LeBron, Kev, and Champ, Jones's nickname. You're like, Chan, why did you include us? Jefferson said. He's like, I don't know, you guys are the ones I wanted to talk to. All of a sudden, the four of us are texting throughout a game. You have this 7-foot professional goofball that walks in and everything changes. Channing doesn't know about the supposed locker room dynamic. Channing doesn't know anything. He's an adult kid, and he's going to send stupid jokes, and now we're all sending stupid jokes to one another, and he's kind of breaking down barriers. And when you inject that energy of a guy that just wants to be friends with everybody, wants to laugh with everybody, you all realize how good it can be. The Cavs rested some players as the season wound down, causing them to lose a game or two. Irving had a minor ankle issue. Iman Shumpert missed a game with a sore knee. James took several games off, the team trying to keep him as fresh as possible for the playoff run. But they did enough to stay ahead of the Raptors. On the second to last night of the season, they clinched home court advantage throughout the Eastern Conference playoffs, winning their 57th game and beating the Hawks again. James was magnificent with 34 points, and Irving's legs looked strong. He nailed 5 three-pointers to rack up 35 points. Irving had gotten himself in tremendous physical condition, especially considering he missed so much of the season. He was never out of shape early in his career, but he wasn't in the sort of condition that he could have been. His regimented recovery from the knee surgery and Lou's mandated conditioning efforts had worked. Irving was ripped and looking strong. Meanwhile, for all his unusual behavior, James had put together a dominating finish to the season. He was named Eastern Conference Player of the Month for February, March, and April. Stephen Curry was about to win the first ever unanimous MVP award, as the Warriors were about to win their 73rd game. But under the radar, at least as under the radar as James could get, he may have been the league's best player over the finishing kick. After Lou's admonishment about the halftime antics with Wade in Miami, James's focus was noticeably improved. He averaged 28.4 points, 8 rebounds, and 8.5 assists, and shot 51% on three-pointers and 63% overall for the rest of the season. He had gotten to a point in his career where he slowly built during the year, aiming to ramp up for the playoffs. Maybe he'd have played his best and more focused basketball over the final 2 months with Blatt as the coach too. Or maybe Lou's style of challenging him was really making a difference. The Cavs front office believed it was the latter. Combined with Love's improved play after his cursing session with Lou, the team was feeling rather good about itself. Not everyone agreed. They'd had so many bad losses and so many times they'd looked like they'd arrived only to fall back. It was hard to believe they'd really turned a corner. Lou, a realist, knew what he saw. With James playing this well and him feeling his team coming closer together and getting into shape, he could see it. "I hope LeBron can keep it up," he said. "If he plays like this, man, we're going to be tough to beat."
Chapter 16, Lil' Kev. Stan Van Gundy was irked. It was in the midst of a playoff game, the first one for the Detroit Pistons in 7 years, and there was a microphone in his face for the standard in-game interview that has become a regular part of nationally televised games. The heavily favored Cavs were ahead by just 2 points after the first quarter. "A couple of calls have upset our guys," Van Gundy complained to Lisa Salters of ESPN. "They've got to understand, LeBron's LeBron. They're not going to call offensive fouls on him. He gets to do whatever he wants. They've got to understand that." Over the years, a parade of underdogs had applied an array of tactics to deal with James in playoff series. They'd tried to beat him up, swarm him, leave him isolated, bait him into fights, and so on. Van Gundy revealed his strategy early. He was going to try to goad officials into calling fouls on James. Van Gundy had beaten James as an underdog before, in the 2009 conference finals when he coached the Orlando Magic. James was brilliant in that series, averaging 38.5 points, 8 rebounds, and 8 assists before losing in 6 games. He had done it with a benign tumor that had developed in his jaw area, which was removed in an intricate 4-hour surgery 2 days after the series ended. Van Gundy's strategy of shutting down James's teammates had worked in that series, and he was working on another move 7 years later. The league dinged Van Gundy with a $25,000 fine for the comment, but it was only the beginning of the Pistons trying to get under James's skin. Despite being the number 8 seed, Detroit felt the Cavs might be vulnerable. They'd had a worse record under Ty Lue, 27-14, than the fired David Blatt, 30-11, as their defense sagged after the change. Also, the Pistons believed the Cavs' best players, James and Kyrie Irving, could be goaded into taking three-pointers, and that was exactly what the Pistons wanted. James shot 31% during the season on threes, his lowest percentage since his rookie season, as he'd fallen into a bad habit of losing balance on long shots. Irving, his legs not quite as strong as usual after he returned from knee surgery, had hit 32% on threes, the worst season of his career. What the Pistons didn't consider was Irving's rigorous conditioning during the second half of the season had got him into the best shape of his career. Over the final 5 games of the regular season, his 3-point shooting had jumped to 42%. So Detroit backed off and dared the stars to shoot. With James, their defenders gave him space and waited back in position, hoping he'd either take a long shot or run over them for offensive fouls. The Cavs won game one, but by just 5 points. Irving took advantage of all the space the Pistons were giving him and drilled 5 3-pointers to finish with 31 points. Kevin Love made 4 3-pointers and had 28. James had 22 points and 11 rebounds. But the Pistons were undeterred, especially rookie Stanley Johnson. He'd first played against James 2 summers before. While James was having meetings and considering his jump to Cleveland during his Nike camp in Las Vegas, he played a pickup game with Johnson on the other side. About to start at the University of Arizona, Johnson was aggressive and rough with James, and certainly unafraid, trash-talking the legend at his own camp. Johnson played several minutes of effective defense on James in Game 1, and then made himself the center of attention afterward. "We think, we know, we can win the series," he said. "Honestly, LeBron's a physical guy, but if he wants to try and grab me and throw me to the floor and you call a foul on me, I just don't understand that. I've never had a person grab my jersey and try to throw me to the floor." Between Van Gundy and Johnson, the Pistons' strategy was transparent. I'm not having an individual matchup with Stan, or an individual matchup with Stan Lee, or any other Stan they can possess, James said with a dismissive shrug. There had been a litany of antagonists in his playoff past, including Deshaun Stevenson of the Washington Wizards and Lance Stevenson of the Indiana Pacers, both journeyman guards who attempted unorthodox playoff tactics with James. Stevenson had famously tried blowing in James's ear during playoff games. A few minutes into Game 2, the Pistons were up 9, and Johnson was a part of the hot start. James then sent a message as the two passed on the floor, leaning into Johnson and purposely bumping him, a literal brushback. "I'm definitely in his head, that's for sure," Johnson said. "I don't know what you take from that. I don't take anything from it but a cheap shot, a cheap-ass bump." Problem was, Johnson's act didn't work. James made 7 of 9 shots that night when Johnson was guarding him. He was even making three-pointers, shaking his head as the Pistons gave him space. He ended with 27 points. J.R. Smith made 7 three-pointers, Irving added 4 more, and the Cavs ended up winning by 17. The Pistons' strategy wasn't working, but Johnson doubled down. "He jabbers, he moves his mouth sometimes," he said. "Their whole team does, kind of like their little cheerleaders on the bench. They're always saying something like they're actually in the game. They might as well be in the stands, in my opinion." After the game, Van Gundy dismissed a coaching move by Lou that had proven quite effective. Lou jostled his lineup to make James essentially the point guard of the second unit, while making sure Love and Irving played together while James was resting. In the past, Lou and Blatt had always tried to keep James and Love together, with Irving being out there with the second unit. It was a small but impactful change that ended up being one of Lou's finest strategy moves in the entire postseason. But like Johnson had run his mouth with James, Van Gundy mocked Lou. "That's really smart coaching, it is. That's really smart coaching to put LeBron on the floor," Van Gundy said. "I give him a lot of credit for that adjustment, if that's what you want to call it." Meanwhile, Van Gundy's game plan of daring the Cavs to shoot threes was not working. They made 20 of them. The Cavs ended up sweeping the series after taking games 3 and 4 in Detroit. Love, James, and Irving all scored over 20 points in game 3, in which the Pistons moved on to roughhousing James. During the second quarter, Pistons center Andre Drummond elbowed James in the neck. He was not disciplined by the league, part of a trend of the NBA allowing rough play as Boston Celtics guard Isaiah Thomas avoided suspension after hitting Atlanta Hawks guard Dennis Schroeder in the head in another series. "Initially, I was surprised," said James, who believed for years that the NBA let opponents get away with hard fouls on him, even as the opponents insisted it was he who got favorable whistles. "But then I thought who he did it to, and I wasn't surprised." Game 4 was decided by 2 points, and the Pistons were furious over calls at the end. Irving had 31 points, finishing off a masterpiece of a series. He hit 4 three-pointers, shooting 47% for the 4 games. He led the Cavs in scoring at 27.5 points, just the second time in 34 career playoff series that James didn't lead his team in scoring. When it was over, Irving shouted, "bye-bye," to courtside fans who'd been heckling him. James walked off the floor without shaking any Pistons players' hands. Forgetting about their opponents, Cavs players began praising Lou for his game plans and in-game moves in the series, including a late out-of-bounds play in Game 3 that freed Irving for a clinching three-pointer with less than 2 seconds on the shot clock. "We definitely recognize it and understand that's his first challenge, and he succeeded as well as any coach could," James said. "He physically, mentally, and spiritually prepared us every single night. For him, his first playoffs, he's been great," Tristan Thompson said. "We were like, man, you can just see it on the court, his poise. It's his first time, and a lot of guys might be nervous or shaking or come to timeouts and not know what to say. But T. Lou, he was fearless." Thompson and James seemed genuine in their comments, but it also again felt like the statements were coded. Players often noticed Blatt's discomfort in huddles and sometimes losing track of everything from who was in the game to the number of timeouts. As if the point hadn't been hammered home enough, the Cavs players kept piling on with how much they liked playing for their new coach. The drive to the airport and the loading of the equipment in the cargo hold takes longer than the actual 25-minute flight between Detroit and Cleveland. But in that span, something happened that would become a galvanizing moment. As he waited for the flight to leave, Richard Jefferson started flipping through a magazine that was in the seat back pocket. He came across an ad for a Tommy Bahama tropical shirt, and the model had a striking resemblance to Love, right down to the length of the beard. Love had a mixed history when it came to bonding with teammates, even with his dry, likable sense of humor. He also had done some modeling for clothing lines, something teammates were quite aware of. Jefferson was the class clown, and, united with Channing Frye, he was constantly on the lookout for ways to lighten the mood. Jefferson roared with laughter at the ad and immediately tore it out and began passing it around the plane. With the euphoria of having just won a series, the team was in a good mood. Teammates took turns putting the photo in front of their faces and doing impressions of Love. They nicknamed the model Little Kev. Over the next several days, Jefferson started bringing the page to team functions. He arrived at Love's house to pick him up for a team dinner several days later with Little Kev in the front seat and Frye relegated to the back. It was a dose of camaraderie that was particularly useful in the playoffs, and it helped bring Love out of his shell, something team staffers marveled at as he truly embraced the ongoing prank. The team had plenty of time for antics as they had to wait 8 days between playoff games. They got the Hawks in the second round in a rematch of the previous season's conference finals. In that span, something more interesting than Little Kev happened. Warriors star Stephen Curry slipped in a pool of sweat in a playoff game in Houston, causing him to fall and sprain his knee, knocking him out for several weeks. The Warriors won the series, but after what seemed like no adversity for 2 years, it was the first time they faced some uncertainty. The Cavs, who had faded into the background a little as the Warriors assembled a 73-win season, took notice. The Cavs didn't seem to have much concern for the Hawks. They swept that series too, running their playoff win streak to 8. The hot 3-point shooting from the Pistons series didn't just carry over. It became a central part of the game plan, as the usually stout Atlanta defense was unable to keep up with the Cavs' perimeter players. Lou once again made a strong coaching move, deploying lineups with Love and Frye playing together. Though that lineup was defensively suspect, the Hawks were unable to handle the array of long-range options. The Cavs won Game 2 by 25 points and hit a playoff record 25 three-pointers, with a starting lineup combining for 18 of them. Smith made 7 by himself. The box score looked like something from another league. The team made 9 more three-point baskets than two-point baskets. It continued in Game 3 as they made 20 more threes, this time Frye hitting 7 in one of the finest games of his career. "We didn't prepare for Love and Frye playing together," Hawks center Al Horford said. "They took advantage." After seeing the Warriors dismantle the league with three-point shooting, the Cavs were now doing it better than their rivals. The addition of Frye made a difference, but Irving and James emerging from long slumps was just as important. As the bench celebrated each make, Lou stood stoically as his plans for an open, up-tempo offense blossomed in front of him. Game 4 was closer, the Cavs winning by a single point, with James making the game-winning basket and the game-winning defensive play in the final minute. But it was Love's turn that night. He nailed 8 three-pointers, with his teammates shouting about Little Kev the whole way. By this point, the tattered ad had been laminated for protection and was traveling with the team like a mascot. The Hawks lamented a few calls, including a suspect goaltend on Paul Millsap, but after 16 more three-pointers, it was clear the better team had moved on. The Cavs set a slate of new records for their shooting, the 77 three-pointers they hit in the 4 games perhaps being the most jaw-dropping. After the game, there was a buffet set up outside the team locker room. Players heading to the bus stopped by the table to get a meal to take with them. As Love worked his way down the line, a call echoed down the concrete hall from a group of his teammates. "Don't forget to make a plate for Little Kev!" You can't tell me little Kev didn't matter during the playoffs, Jefferson said. It's so random. Think about something as random as little Kev. 30, 40 years from now, someone will show a picture of that, and there will be fans that will be like, oh, that's little Kev. It was an excellent tool. It gave the fans something that they really enjoyed. I'll stand by the fact that it put our team in a different light. It showed how much fun we were having. It showed that we had something unique, something all our own. The team had to wait 9 days for its next opponent, as it took the Toronto Raptors 7 games to win their second round series with the Miami Heat. In that time, the Cavs practiced, but their passion was more on the growing little Kev phenomenon. The Cavs marketing department had developed a slogan, a campaign for the playoffs weeks in advance, all in. This was a poker reference that owner Dan Gilbert, who also owned several casinos, including one in Cleveland, always liked. Shoving all the chips into the middle, as Gilbert did with his $160 million payroll, was a reasonable way to term it. It was on huge banners on the exterior of the arena, on signage around the interior, and printed on tens of thousands of t-shirts. But as far as the team was concerned, little Kev was the rallying cry for their postseason run. In the days that passed, as the Cavs killed time, the meme grew. Players started wearing t-shirts with the face of the unsuspecting model from the Tommy Bahama ad. Masks were made, and players ordered up the gaudy shirt the ad was pitching and began wearing it. There was something else, too, that the team was doing to build camaraderie, but it remained a secret. Late in the regular season, James Jones approached the Cavs owners with an idea for the playoffs. He wanted the team to have a symbol, a motivation, to use during the playoffs. After discussion, the idea was hatched for a puzzle of 16 pieces, all in gold, one for each win that would be needed to gain the title. When fully assembled, the puzzle would form the Larry O'Brien Trophy. After each victory, a different Cavs player would set a golden piece in place, the trophy slowly being put together. Then it would be hidden away in a special case and would travel everywhere with the team during the postseason. We needed something to bring us together, Jones said. Every guy was a piece. We assembled this team, so we had to assemble the puzzle. The Raptors arrived in Cleveland fatigued and wounded. Their starting center, Jonas Valanciunas, was out with injury, and they only had 1 day to recover after eliminating the Heat. They had also been shaken by watching the film of the Cavs hitting all those three-pointers against Atlanta and entered with a quickly tossed-together game plan to try to slow them down. It did work and it didn't. The Cavs only made 7 three-pointers in Game 1, but they made 28 baskets in the paint and crushed Toronto by 31 points. James and Irving combined to make 22 of 30 shots. Kyle Lowry, the Raptors' stout point guard, a major concern for Cleveland, scored only 8 points. Game 2 was nearly as lopsided. The Cavs won by 19 points as James, Irving, and Love combined for 65 points. Smith, who arrived with a sports coat over his little Kev shirt, made 3 three-pointers. Lowry managed just 10 points and walked off the bench to the locker room before the end of the first half in frustration. It was a decision that got him roasted by the Toronto media, especially after he said he needed to leave the floor to relax his mind. Hall of Famer Kareem Abdul-Jabbar attended the game and stopped by the Cavs locker room. He waited for James, and when the Cavs star arrived, they embraced. "How do you feel?" Abdul-Jabbar asked James after congratulating him on the win. At that point, the Cavs were 10-0 in the postseason, had won the first 2 games of the conference finals by a combined 50 points, and James had played just 2 games in the previous 12 days. He'd had a triple-double that night in just 33 minutes. Meanwhile, Curry was just limping back from his knee injury as the Warriors had to fight their way through the second round and had fallen behind the Oklahoma City Thunder in the Western Finals. "I feel great," James said. For the better part of 2 years, the Cavs had gotten used to a near-constant state of drama. Whether it was with each other, with their coach, or with injuries, there had rarely been any period of successful calm. Now, finally, there was. They were playing brilliantly, They were healthy. They were generally in a good place with their coach. And, thanks to Fry and Jefferson, they'd never been looser as a group. They took the short flight to Toronto and posed for pictures together on the sunny tarmac as Canadian customs officials searched their baggage for contraband, a little home country advantage as the visiting team got some extra scrutiny. At that point, even airport delays couldn't spoil their mood. They finally tasted a little adversity in Game 3 when the Raptors rallied back to win by 15 points. Irving and Love played miserably, combining to shoot 4 of 28. James was hit flush in the jaw by Thompson by accident. He assumed it was one of the Raptors who hit him, and when he tumbled to the court, some thought he was exaggerating for effect. "I'm not trying to sell a call. I got hit with an elbow," James growled on the matter. "Sell a call for what? There was no call there to be sold. That's it. I was going to say something else to you, but I'm going to leave it alone." Late in the game, Raptors backup center Bismack Biyombo leveled James with a flagrant foul, wrapping his arm around his neck on a drive and pulling him to the court. The crowd cheered Biyombo, who was making his presence felt as he played in place of Valanciunas, and James hopped up to confront him. In the final 15 seconds, end-of-bench Cavs player Dante Jones entered the game and hit Biyombo in the groin with a closed fist, dropping the Congolese big man to the ground. Jones was suspended by the league for the next game. James, recognizing Jones had leveled the blow as a defense to him, offered to pay his fine. It was an interesting gesture that only added to the spice that was suddenly injected into the series. However, Jones's salary for the entire year had just been $8,800 because he'd signed on the last day of the season. By the calculation used for suspension fines, he was only docked $80. James made $210,000 per game. Raptors coach Dwayne Casey, unsatisfied with the victory, attacked the referees because the Cavs had shot 27 more free throws over the first three games. "Bismack is getting fouled so much, he's not getting the calls," Casey said. "He's getting hit. There's one play where they almost have a brawl. He gets killed on that play. Some of those fouls are unbelievable." The league fined Casey $25,000. The Raptors then didn't go to the foul line for the entire first half of Game 4. It didn't hurt. Lowry finally arrived and scored 35 points as he repeatedly bested the Cavs' perimeter defense. DeMar DeRozan, his backcourt mate, scored 32, and the Raptors won by 6 points. They'd evened the series at 2-2. And for the first time, it looked like the Cavs had some weaknesses. Love played poorly again, shooting 4 of 14. He was 5 of 23 in the two games in Toronto, and Lou benched him in the fourth quarter. In the locker room, Love's teammates noticed he was down. This, in reality, was where all the bonding would matter. For all the jokes and the t-shirts, that was where the relationships would truly be tested. Sure enough, the first two to be at his side were Fry and Jefferson. Little Kev was not the topic. "Channing basically told me that no one's immune in the NBA playoffs. These things happen. You have to keep fighting through it. In order for us to win, he said I need to be aggressive," Love said. "I give him credit for staying on me and staying vocal." Jefferson kept the mood light. The Raptors' playoff slogan was, "We the North," a communal reference to Toronto's geographic location. As Jefferson left the building, he made a proclamation. "We the South will be fine." Before Game 5, Lou also approached Love for a chat. Weeks earlier, when Lou held that emotional meeting in New York City, he'd appealed to Love's ego in telling him he was a star and he should start acting like it. This time, he was more encouraging, and he urged Love to stay involved and look to shoot his way out of the slump. The team had learned Love by then, and they knew he was prone to getting down on himself. They'd found a way to bring him out of his shell with the comedy of his alter ego. It worked. Love exploded in the next game, making his first 6 shots. He scored 19 points in the first half and 25 for the game as the Cavs smashed Toronto by 38 points to take back the series lead. James, Irving, and Love together put up 71 points, one of the classic three-pronged attacks that the foundation of the team was built on. I've been a part of some really adverse situations, and I just didn't believe that this was one of them, James said. From the very moment we lost Game 4, I was just very calm about the whole situation. This was a kind way of saying that despite what had happened in Toronto, he wasn't really worried about the Raptors. He proved to be correct when the Cavs ended the series 2 days later with a 26-point win back in Toronto. James was strong, scoring 33 points with 11 rebounds. Irving had 30 of his own, and Love 20, as the Cavs' might showed through. It was the 25th consecutive series that James personally had been part of a road win, breaking an obscure and seemingly untouchable Michael Jordan record. He was off to the finals for the sixth time in a row and the seventh time in his career. Yet he celebrated after the victory like few times he had in his career, embracing teammates and clutching them by the shoulders in gratification. I didn't appreciate last year, myself personally, getting to the finals, James said. Just so much was going on in my mind, knowing that Kevin was out for the rest of the season and knowing that Kyrie was dealing with injuries all the way from the first round. I just didn't appreciate it. It's definitely a different feeling. Having these guys right here at full strength, having our team at full strength, and the way I feel personally, I appreciate this moment. To be able to be part of it and to be there once again. As he'd told Abdul-Jabbar the week before, he was feeling great. There was no champagne in the locker room. The team hadn't wanted to go all out in the celebration. So the team showered each other with what they had, water, lots and lots of water. As they bounced around, they picked up buckets of ice supposed to be used to soak their knees and feet, and instead started throwing them around the room. The visiting locker room at the Air Canada Center has rubber floors. It's primarily designed as a hockey dressing room, and the water turned the room into a slippery lake. The Cavs were going back to the finals, and if they could avoid any falls on the wet floor, they'd be going healthy this time. Smith took possession of the trophy the team had won that night, and he didn't want to let it go. But he needed a shower, and so he kissed it and set it on the top of his locker for safety. "I'll be right back," he said, addressing the silver ball. "I'm going to get your golden sister next." Chapter 17. Follow My Lead. After dinner on the evening of June 3rd, LeBron James came back to his hotel suite at the Four Seasons in downtown San Francisco with his small group of friends that he kept close during the playoffs. The room looked over Yerba Buena Gardens, but the focus was on the room's 50-inch flat screen. Earlier that day, Muhammad Ali had passed away, and the entire nation was engaged in remembrance. James had an affinity for Ali as a child, but his respect for him had grown dramatically as he got older and felt a kinship with him as he went through a similar experience of becoming a global sports celebrity. James came to understand that Ali had been a pioneer for someone like him. They would eventually meet as Ali attended several games James played in Phoenix, where Ali lived. Ali also held a special place in the heart of Lynn Merritt, the Nike vice president who oversaw James's partnership with the corporate giant. Merritt was a role model for James, and he sometimes played the part of father figure. He'd been by his side throughout his highs and lows during his entire career. Not only had they done hundreds of millions in deals together, but Merritt was an advisor on some of the biggest moves James made. Merritt was always around James, flying in from his home in Portland for hundreds of games during the seasons. He'd ride to and from playoff games with James, acting as a sounding board or just a support system. In the playoffs, he was ubiquitous. Merritt is from Louisville, Kentucky, where he grew up in an underprivileged section of town near where Ali was raised. As Ali rose to prominence and worldwide fame, Merritt watched as a young man trying to advance in the world himself. He felt a connection to Ali. Both had gotten out of Louisville and made it. Though he took efforts to stay out of the spotlight, Merritt was one of the most powerful people in basketball. He is a kingmaker. Before his relationship with James, he acted as Ken Griffey Jr.'s main connection to the company. Merritt would never admit it out loud, but the finals rematch between the Warriors and Cavs took on special meaning. The Warriors had rallied from being down 3-1 to the Oklahoma City Thunder to win three straight and get back to defend their title. In Game 6, they trailed by 8 points going into the fourth quarter in OKC, and Klay Thompson bailed them out with a breathtaking shooting performance, scoring 19 points with 5 3-pointers in the fourth quarter. Then Stephen Curry shot them into the finals by making 7 3-pointers and scoring 36 in Game 7 in Oakland, while he was still recovering from the knee injury earlier in the playoffs. Curry was fast becoming the most popular player in the league. James, who finished third in MVP voting behind Curry and the San Antonio Spurs' Kawhi Leonard, conceded Curry deserved the award, but pointed out, "I think sometimes the word valuable or best player of the year, you can have different results. When you talk about most valuable, then you can have a different conversation." The conversation James wanted to have but couldn't was that he didn't see any player who could touch his value. The Cavs were the worst team in the NBA the 4 years he was gone, and when he came back, they were in the finals twice. Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love were great players, but never played in the playoffs before joining James. Though they had injuries, the Miami Heat cratered and missed the playoffs the year after James left them, following 4 straight finals appearances. That, James believed, is value. Beyond that, Curry was a deeper rival. In 2013, Nike had passed on matching Curry after a lucrative offer from competitor Under Armour. Nike hadn't prioritized Curry, whose early career was marred by ankle injuries, and they had a deep roster with James, Kobe Bryant, and Kevin Durant among many others, including Irving. Curry had gone on to an explosive 3 seasons where his sweet shooting ability, attractive baby face, and beautiful family had made him a marketing superstar. Young kids adored him, and Under Armour had mirrored that rise as they continued to emerge as a thorn in Nike's side. So for Merritt, this was more than just supporting James. It was, in many ways, Nike versus Under Armour at the highest profile level. It was James and Irving, 2 players with their own Nike lines, against UA's signature man. Yet Merritt knew the task for James and the Cavs was going to be extreme. The Warriors had staggered a little in the postseason, but they were almost unbeatable at home, and they had momentum after beating the Thunder 3 straight. When he came to San Francisco for the start of the finals, Merritt brought with him a DVD of Ali's famous Thrilla in Manila fight, the 1975 bout between Ali and Joe Frazier that was regarded as one of the greatest fights of all time. Ali and Frazier were bitter rivals, and this fight settled their rivalry, the 3rd fight after each had beaten each other once. Merritt got the disc and slipped it in for James to watch. The room quickly got emotional as the 45-year-old footage played, not just as they watched the fighters work, Frazier smashing Ali with 2 vicious left hooks that sent him to the ropes, and then Ali coming back with a series of bruising blows that ended up forcing Frazier's corner to stop the fight after the 14th round, but Ali's accomplishments in his life that had just ended. It was an unbelievable pound-for-pound slugfest. Just 2 greats seizing the opportunity and seizing the moment to be in it and do what they love to do, James said. He paved the way for guys like myself. I understand that he is the greatest of all time, and he was the greatest of all time because of what he did outside of the ring. Obviously, we knew how great of a boxer he was, but I think that was only 20% of what made him as great as he was. I mean, it's a guy who basically had to give up a belt and relish everything he had done because of what he believed in and ended up in jail because of his beliefs. It's a guy who stood up for so many different things throughout the times where it was so difficult for African Americans to even walk in the streets. Within a few months, James donated $2.5 million for an Ali exhibit at the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. His production company also made a deal with HBO to make a documentary about Ali's life. The Cavs had lost Game 1 to the Warriors, 104-89. It was a missed opportunity. Curry and Thompson, the Warriors' 2 great weapons, had not played well. Curry missed 11 of his 15 shots, and Thompson made just one three-pointer. But the Warriors' bench, led by lanky and talented backup guard Sean Livingston's 20 points, had felled the Cavs. The Cavs were briefly ahead in the third quarter, leading Warriors coach Steve Kerr to angrily smash a clipboard on the bench in a rare outburst. But they didn't have enough down the stretch, a feeling that was all too much like the previous season. J.R. Smith, whose contributions were needed, burned off the outer layer of skin on his right hand diving for a ball in the first quarter, and was in so much discomfort he didn't shoot for the rest of the game. This was all on James's and Merritt's minds as they finished the night and finished the fight. They talked about what was ahead of James, down 0-1 in the finals to the Warriors again. They knew he was going to need something special to pull this off. He was going to need a few heroic performances to beat Golden State. A few Ali-esque moments. Maybe three, they thought. But one didn't come the next day. Some within the Warriors privately felt beating the Thunder, a team that had given them problems throughout the season, was the tallest mountain they needed to climb. It would be hard to argue that. The bookies and the computers agreed they were the heavy favorites coming into the series, and it only appeared to confirm that when they totally smashed the Cavs 110-77 in Game 2. It was the seventh consecutive time they'd beaten the Cavs, dating to the previous finals, and the third time by double digits in the four meetings that season. Draymond Green, a player the Cavs struggled to defend, scored 28 points. And again, neither Thompson nor Curry got red hot, although combined with Green, the All-Star trio had 13 three-pointers, and Golden State still won easily. The 48 total points they'd outscored the Cavs by set a record for widest margin for the first two games in finals history. With the confidence flowing, the Warriors couldn't help themselves as they started to brag about their destined place in history. I don't really look at, are you the best team of all time? Are we the best team of all time? Because I think it's all subjective. To say we're better than the Showtime Lakers, how can you say that? We never played them, Green said before Thompson cut him off. We are better than the Showtime Lakers, said Thompson with confidence. His father, Michael, won two titles with the Showtime Lakers in the 1980s. Green then compared the Warriors to the 1995-96 Bulls, the team whose regular season win streak the Warriors had beat that season. Like saying we're better than the Bulls, it's like we'll never play them. It's two completely different eras, so I don't really get off on are you the best team of all times. Regardless of the argument, that Green and Thompson were openly indulging it midway through a series was a window into their feelings. They were confident they were a few days away from finishing off a title and taking their place among the all-time greats. The Cavs could have been miffed at the perceived slight, but they had bigger issues. They'd been embarrassed. A year of talking about getting a chance at the Warriors with their full team and things being different. Well, there was a difference. They were getting beat worse. As the team was getting ready to pack up and head home, assistant coach Phil Handy asked Lou if he could address the team. Handy is a development specialist. He works with players individually on skills before and after practices and games. He was a holdover from Byron Scott's staff in Cleveland, now two coaches ago. Irving and Handy had a close relationship, mostly from all their workouts together. He was rarely vocal. During games, he sat behind the bench and didn't take part in much in-game strategy. But he was an Oakland native, and he was furious that the team had been crushed in his hometown. Handy unleashed a stream of expletives admonishing the team for lackluster play. He couldn't believe they'd allowed themselves to get whipped in such a vitally important game. The players were taken aback. Most of them had never seen this side of Handy. It wouldn't help defending the three-pointer, but it was a new voice rattling the situation to get them thinking. Love didn't hear it. He was already gone from the locker room, feeling nauseous and disoriented. Late in the first half, the Warriors' Harrison Barnes caught him with an elbow. Love dropped to the ground and clutched his head. Lou called a timeout, but Love stayed in the game and finished the half. A few moments later, he made a three-pointer. He went to the locker room with his teammates. I didn't even know what happened, but at halftime he showed no symptoms, Lou said. He didn't talk about it. Early in the third quarter, though, Love started to get woozy and couldn't run in a straight line. He was quickly pulled from the game and died.